Hello, welcome back from spring break. I hope you guys had a wonderful, wonderful week off. Today is a beautiful day. It's a little cold, but the sun is out and it's the first day of spring. So happy spring. I'm here to you today to talk about batterer interventions. As you've noticed throughout the semester, I've talked a lot about how when you are providing treatment for the batterer or the abuser, that it is very important that we do not recommend couples counseling or anger management. The literature shows that both of those are not best practices for this population. Let's talk a little bit about couples intervention. The reason why we don't recommend couples counseling for these couples is because this is a relationship based on power and control, based on abuse by power and control. So there is the dominant party and the vulnerable one, which is, in our case, the survivor. Some people will refer to him or her as the victim. And so there's always this division of power. And remember, intimate partner violence is not just about physical abuse. So there's verbal abuse, there's emotional abuse. I don't really get into the movies. Most of the movies that depict intimate partner violence to me are very inaccurate, but there is one. It's an older movie, but it stars Julia Roberts and it's called Sleeping with the Enemy. Yeah, Sleeping with the Enemy. And in that movie, there's a scene where they are at a party, a big party, lots of people there, and they are across the room from each other. And he gives her a look, the husband, the batterer, gives her a look from across the room that just chills you to your bone. And she knows what that look means. Even though there are many other people in the room, they don't even know what's going on. And they probably don't even see anything any differently because he's quite charming, which is very common of batterers. But that look just says so much. And so abuse is about that power and control where you can look at the person that you're abusing and they already know what's up. So in a couple session, there's going to always be that division of power and control, and you cannot do effective couples counseling with this couple because that's always there, whether you as the therapist are aware of it as or not. Little things that can be said, there can be looks, there can be gestures exchanged between the two, and if there is also physical abuse in this relationship, you could easily engage them in a conversation in therapy that could lead to that person being in even more harm's way. So that's why we don't do couples counseling with these couples. Additionally, in my personal opinion, I think it's very important when you're working with a couple that you ask separately. You know, there's always a time when you're doing that initial assessment that you should meet with each party individually, whether you're doing couples counseling or family counseling. And at that point, I think you should ask about intimate partner violence. It's very important. I always do that, and I will not treat a couple if there is intimate partner violence in that relationship. So that's why we don't do that. Anger management. Anger management, and this is your professor's opinion, but I'm not a big fan of anger management because I believe that anger is usually a symptom of something else. And when we're targeting the anger, particularly in a group setting, I've never found it to go well. I've done anger management groups for the military, and it just ended up being a contest to see who was the angriest. I don't know. I just don't find it to be effective. If you are dealing with anger and learning how to cope with it, I do find that I personally have had more success in an individual session. But I only address coping skills for the anger after we get to the root of whatever the issue is. There's a reason why you're angry. Particularly men, what I found, and this is definitely a little off the subject of intimate partner violence, but in working with men, I find that anger is the thing that may bring them to therapy because it begins to make them uncomfortable when the anger gets out of control. But if you're doing a thorough assessment, you'll find that there are other symptoms. But because they're men and, you know, they're nurtured in a different way, sometimes they don't even realize it's an issue. It's just a feeling that they're uncomfortable with, that they just stuff. With women, particularly women who may be batterers, sort of the same thing. There are other symptoms there that came before the anger. It's usually when the anger gets out of control, where they've gotten into a fight or gotten into trouble or something like that, that they seek therapy. So just something to remember. But anyway, we do not do anger management in a case of abuse, simply because that is not the problem. Abuse is not about anger. It's not about one party being so angry that they want to abuse the partner. And when I say batter, I mean, again, not just physical abuse, but emotional, verbal, possibly sexual abuse. And so that's not a problem of anger. It's about power and control. And at this point, I'll refer you back to the power and control wheel that we discussed at the beginning of the term. So when you have a person that is a batterer or an abuser that's seeking treatment, what you want to do is refer them to a batterer's intervention and prevention program, and it is commonly known as BIPP, B-I-P-P. You should be able to find these type programs in a crisis center or a domestic violence shelter. Most shelters offer services to the batterers as well. Of course, they're not in the same place for safety's sake, but they do have those. These programs are facilitated by facilitators who are trained to do this program and to do this intervention. So you and I don't just go and do a BIPP program. The attendees also have to pay for this program. I don't think you're going to find one that's free. And the reasoning behind the payment is accountability and having them to be responsible for their behavior. There are many different curricula out there for BIPP programs. But what you want is a BIPP program. That is the appropriate intervention. And I also believe that individual counseling in conjunction with the BIPP group is probably going to be best practices for this this person that's seeking services from you. Let me see if I wanted to cover anything else. You'll often find that these BIPP groups are not co-ed. They will have some, they will be gender specific. They'll have some for men and they'll have some for women. But I've never known any to be co-ed. I suspect they might exist, but for the most part, they're going to be separate. I want to tell you a little bit about my personal experience with this type group. So I was working for the military, and I had been moved around a bit at this particular installation simply because they were short in different places. And so there was one department that I wanted to go to, but I was a little reserved because it was a family advocacy program. And in that program, it's not family advocacy in terms of, oh, let's just help families. It's usually it's treating and assessing intimate partner violence and also child abuse. Any type of abuse. I believe I mentioned earlier that in a military setting that intimate partner violence is something that's reported just like child abuse in the civilian sector. And so you have the social workers there either provide assessments, which is similar to what CPS workers do in the community. They don't call it an investigation because it's done by a therapist and it's more of an assessment, but there is a hearing type thing. Yeah, a case review hearing, I believe, is what they used to call it, where they look at the facts of the case and determine if it met criteria for whatever type of abuse or not. And then there were consequences after that for the soldier if it did meet. So I'll talk about that a little bit more when we talk about the military population. But anyhow, the other side of that, the flip side of that, is there was treatment provided, individual and group treatment. There were lots of groups going on. And one of the groups was for male soldiers who were being assessed for intimate partner violence, and that could have been physical, emotional, verbal, or sexual abuse. They covered all four. And so these soldiers, all male, have been accused by someone, whether that be their partner or someone in their chain of command or someone who had witnessed it. And so the Army is very proactive, and they automatically put you in treatment before they even found out if it happened or not. And so I didn't want to go to this department because I had no desire to work with batterers. And of course, I went over to the department, and one of the first groups I get is this group. Now, it's not a BIP group. They did have BIP groups, and I'm definitely not trained to do BIP, mainly because I didn't have a desire to do it then. But, you know, things have changed. So anyway, I get this group, and this is, I don't even know what you call it. It was called Perpetrators. I honestly can't remember what it was called, but the curriculum that we used was called Domestic Violence Stop. That was the program. And so it was probably some of the same principles in BIP, but it wasn't the formal group. And I think the reason for that, we don't want to put them in the BIP group because they weren't found to have met criteria for this type of abuse. They were just accused. But we felt that they could benefit from learning these coping strategies. So the group consisted of male soldiers, a therapist, a social worker, LCSW, who was a male but was prior military, and me, the only female. So I was not excited about this group. But upon starting to facilitate the group, I definitely changed my mind. I learned so much from these guys, and they tell me that it was so important to them to have a woman without a military background in the group because it forced them to model the behaviors that they needed to with me. And that was pretty awesome. And I remember each group, I think I facilitated maybe 3 or 4 cycles of the same group with different participants. And each group was 12 weeks and they met once a week. So about 3 months I'm with these guys. And at the beginning of each group, we would ask the group members what the rules should be. And they always, consistently, without being prompted, would say no degrading of women, no terms, not using the B word, or any other term that's used to degrade women. And I love that. But as we move through, one of the things that I tell all of my group members in any group that I do, I tell them that you might have done a bad thing, but that doesn't mean you're a bad person. That's just something I say with every group because many of them hold a lot of shame and I don't want them to. So it's very interesting because at the end of the group, the last group session where we do the termination, one of the guys told me that that was the turning point for him in the group. I remember this guy very well because he didn't seem to be very interested in the group. Sometimes he would fall asleep. He just didn't seem to have any interest in being there. And I specifically remember writing in his notes that his motivation for treatment and for change was very low, was very poor. And, you know, my prognosis was that there would likely not be any change, et cetera, et cetera. And then he tells me that that statement really changed his life because no one had ever told him that. And so to hear that he wasn't a bad person, it made him check back in to the group. And then ironically, after that group was over, he voluntarily did individual sessions with me for about 4 or 5 months. Never, ever would have thought that would have happened. So it really had me to, you know, self-examine myself and look at biases and things that I had and how I may have unfairly judged people. And it also made me realize that, you know, I really can never say I can never work with a certain population because you never know. And apparently with this population, I was effective. I helped them. They also helped me because now I have a much more open mind. And this was after 10 years of practice. So, you know, I would encourage those of you that think you can't work with this population to not be so quick to say that. I'm not saying go and get your BIP certification and start, you know, facilitating BIP groups, but be open to it because you never know. You may try to work with them and then find out, okay, this is not for me. But if you don't try, you'll never know, like me. So anyway, that's what I wanted to share. I'm going to post this in Blackboard, and if you have any questions about the lecture, please post them below. Have a great week, and again, welcome back.